honjitsu wa hitotsubashi daigaku de ohanashi suru kikai o itadaki totemo koe ni omote orimasu. Boto aizatsu igai wa ego deno kogi to naru koto o oyorushi kudasai. So I apologize for a complete lecture in English apart from that. Just to start, and for interest, it is relevant to the lecture. This is where I work, and my office is just there. My brother-in-law very much likes Google Earth, and I couldn't understand why, but now I've used it, it's terrific. Now, watch. The golf courses. Edinburgh. Scotland, Great Britain, and Europe, and a bit more than Europe. So, as Osamu has said, Professor Saito, my talk is about Scotland in the UK, Scotland in the EU, Scotland in the world, mostly about the past, but with some on the present and the future. This is my name. And this is my university. It is the oldest university in Scotland and the third oldest in Britain. It was recently voted the best university in Scotland and, after Oxford and Cambridge, the third best university in Great Britain. The structure of my talk today is as follows. I look, because I am a historian, at Scotland's history of relations with England, with the continent of Europe, and with the rest of the world. I look also at modern politics and the structures of representation in both the United Kingdom, Scotland, and Europe. Later in the talk, I will talk as much as I know about the importance of the European Union to Scotland's present and perhaps future economic success. You have before you, in English, I fear, the full text of the paper I wrote for this seminar. The talk I will give tells you more about the history, and it leaves out many of the details, like the tables about representation, which I think you will find more easily accessible on paper. So first of all, a historical perspective. Some people, though I am sure not this audience, think that Scotland and England are the same. They are not. They share a certain geographical space, which is the island of Britain. They are also bound together and have been for 300 years into a political union, and that political union is called the United Kingdom. Even earlier than that, the monarchies were joined in 1603 when Queen Elizabeth died. The monarchy from Scotland came to occupy the throne of England and to create a united monarchy. For many centuries, both Scotland and England have used mostly the English language. Britain, and in particular Scotland, is essentially a Christian country, and it is a particular kind of Christianity called Protestantism. In much of Europe, Catholicism is the dominant part, the dominant sect of Christianity. Of course, after Scotland joined England in the United Kingdom, it became an imperial power, as was the United Kingdom from perhaps the 17th century, but certainly the 18th century until the 20th century. And in union with England, Scotland experienced an industrial revolution. It was, perhaps with Japan, I think, the first country in the world to be industrialised. Now, those are the things that Scotland and England share, and they are important. But when you look also at the historical perspective, you see there are a number of divergent characteristics. Racially, the Scots have many Celtic and also Norse, which means Scandinavian influences, as well as drawing from an Anglo-Saxon gene pool of the kind that dominates much of England. How much difference those racial differences made is, of course, debatable. Now we don't look so much at race as much as at culture. Scottish law is completely different from England. When the United Kingdom was created in 1707, Scotland's private law, not its public law, but its private law, was safeguarded, and it remains a completely different legal tradition to this day. The experience of government in Scotland is different to England. In England, the state was very strong from an early date. In Scotland, the state was quite weak until a late date. Scottish government is, and always was, very decentralised. The centralisation of the state that you find in England is much less pronounced in Scotland. Scotland and England share Protestantism, but the type of Protestantism in Scotland is very strict. It's much more strict than in England, and that makes a difference to the way the society developed. And nowadays, many people do not go to church. They are not actively religious. But the history of how they have been religious is important to how Scotland is now. The education system, again, is different from England. Scotland was one of the first countries in the world in the 17th century to have a national education system established by law. It also had 5 universities at a time when England only had 2. The experience of population mobility, this is a huge topic I will talk a little more about, is different. People move around in Scotland a lot as they do in England, but the interesting thing about Scotland is that they also move abroad from a very early date. Architecture, art and culture, Scotland's influences are much more European from the continent of Europe than you will find in England. So when you look at buildings in Scotland, you will see that there are important differences in how they look, and many aspects of art and culture draw, for example, on France rather than on England. And finally, it is important to note that Scotland is not just different from England, it is also different from the other component parts of the UK, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Now, what we have is a country which is similar to England in some ways. It has shared experience of empire and industrial revolution, but in other ways, it is different. And those differences create divided loyalties, which is an important theme in my talk. Until 1707, Scotland was completely independent. It was a completely independent state. Again, since 1999, Scotland has become partly independent because the Parliament that was closed in 1707 has reopened, but Scotland now is not a completely independent state. It is partly autonomous, but only partly. So for 3 centuries and still today, this meant divided or multiple loyalties. Scottish people could be both Scottish or they could be British. They could be part of the United Kingdom or they could be both. On top of this, Since 1973, the European Union has further complicated the picture. The European Union is a body, an entity, which is made up of many nation states and also many regions. And those nation states and regions have been historically separate, and that includes Scotland and England. So now, when I speak, Scottish people can be Scottish, they can be British, or they can be European, or any combination of those. Now, Scotland, historically, I have said, had many links with Europe, many more perhaps than with England. The most important ties with Europe were extensive population migration to the continent from even the 13th century. People commented that the Scots were very migratory, that they were found all over Europe. These migrants are mostly young men who go abroad to trade or to fight. There are also strong diplomatic and economic connections with France, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, and the Baltic states, including Germany and including what used to be called Russia. And as I suggested earlier, Scotland's legal, political, and cultural development was shaped more by continental Europe than by England, at least until the 18th century. And that is very important because for centuries Scotland was separate from England. It was a different country. And that means that the relationships that we see nowadays between Scotland and England are touched by what they have shared, but also what they have not shared. And for many years, for many centuries, Scotland and England were at war in one way or another. So there is a tension, a political tension really, and a cultural tension between Scotland and England, which reflects into the way Scotland relates to Europe and the world. So historic links with Europe are very important. The world too has been influenced by Scotland and has influenced the way Scotland develops. I said earlier that England, from an early date, was an exceptionally strong centralized state. It was politically strong, economically strong, and militarily much stronger than Scotland. Scotland, for much of its history until the 18th century, is a much poorer country. It has limited capital. Most of the wealth is owned by landowners. And the population is much smaller than England. The relationship fluctuates over time, but roughly 15% of the population of Britain is made up by Scottish people. Secondly, the society was until perhaps even the 20th century very much dominated socially by a small landowning aristocracy. Only a few thousand people essentially controlled much of the wealth and the political life of Scotland. There were few towns until the 18th century. Agriculture was backward and there were very frequent famines. The industries which existed were basic and low skill. They used mostly raw materials derived from agriculture like wood and leather to make simple industrial products. Now all that changed completely and forever when Scotland joined with England. The reason England wanted to join with Scotland was because Scotland was militarily not that significant, but it had a strong alliance with France, which was a very large and an extremely rich state in the 17th and the 18th centuries. And the link with Scotland gave England diplomatic military and dynastic security. There was an arrangement in the monarchy to give dynastic security. For Scotland, the overwhelming need of union was economic. It was a poor country, a very poor country. It had experienced just before 1707 very bad famines, and much of its fixed capital was lost in, movable capital was lost in an attempt to make an empire in the same way that the English were doing. It was disastrous. The period for 10 or 15 years before 1707 was very bad for Scotland, and the economic imperative drove the Union of 1707. Now, in union with England and as part of the British Empire, Scotland reached out to the whole world. After about 1750, being part of the British Empire opened up the world to Scottish people, especially Scottish men who were prepared to move abroad. The British Empire, as you know, encompassed a quarter of all the people on earth in 1914. And many people said at that time that the British Empire was in many ways a Scottish Empire. And the reason they said that was because many of the soldiers who went to the Empire were Scottish, many much larger proportion than in England, and many of those who ran the Empire, the administrators, were also Scottish because of the very strong educational system that was created, as I said, in the 17th century. So in some ways, the British Empire is really a Scottish Empire. Now, Empire and Union completely transform Scotland's economy within 100 years. It goes from being a very poor country to being almost as rich as England. Not quite as rich, but almost that way. There is rapid industrialisation and rapid urbanisation. In turn, Scotland influenced the world. The education system in North America, especially Princeton, was profoundly influenced. Princeton and Philadelphia were profoundly influenced by the Scottish university system. You also find it in Canada as well. In areas as diverse as agriculture in India, when they wanted to modernize the agriculture of Bengal in the 19th century, the example that they tried to use was Scottish. I know Japan is not a part of the British Empire, but Scotsmen abroad were important. For example, Thomas Glover, I believe, is the most famous Scot in Japan. He was important in industrializing Japan in the 19th century. And finally, you will find Scottish people most prominently peopling Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So that is most of the historical part of the talk. I now move on to talk about Scotland and Europe in modern times. I have argued that Scotland was made by its participation in the British Empire between 1750 and 1914. That period, up to 1914, is the most economically prosperous and the most politically dynamic for Scotland. Things change, unfortunately, after 1918. After 1918, Scotland had mostly heavy industry, and the heavy industry that existed became increasingly subject to competition. Empire became less a source of demand and increasingly a competitor. The textile industry is perhaps the best known example. So after 1918, and especially after the Great Depression of the 1930s, Scotland struggled to regain the economic success that it had enjoyed for 1.5 centuries as part of empire. And that is one of the reasons why Scotland sought, after 1945, outside investment to bolster its flagging industry and to bring in new lighter industries with hopefully more value added from, for example, the USA in the 1950s and 1960s, and in the 1960s and 1970s from Japan. Now that is Scotland and the world, and for 300 years, certainly for more than 200 years, Scotland's perspective was to England and then to empire. Europe was for centuries forgotten. That changed again in the 1970s when Britain, the United Kingdom, joined the European Union. And Europe now has revived. It is much more central to all sorts of debates on economy and politics. It has revived as a focus of economic opportunity, legislation, and identity. And what I'm going to show now, I hope, is that to understand Scotland in modern Europe, we need to study not just economics, which is, after all, not my specialism, but also the politics of Scotland in the UK and the EU. So, a very simple summary of British politics. Britain has three main political parties. The biggest now is called Labour. It is a left-of-centre party and is broadly in favour of the European Union. I say broadly in favour. It is difficult to find anyone who is completely in favour, but I will try to explain that more fully in a minute. Secondly, the Conservative Party, which ran Britain in the 1980s and the early 1990s, is a much more right-wing party. It is not sympathetic to Europe. The phrase you will see in all the newspapers, I'm sure you have seen it, which I brought it up, as a piece of jargon, is Eurosceptic. They are doubtful that the European Union is necessarily a good thing on balance. And then a relatively new party, the Liberal Democrats, who are centrist, and they are the most pro-Europe. I believe their policies embrace what happens in Europe more completely than do any of the others. Now, these are the main British political parties. All three support the Union of 1707, in other words, keeping Britain together as England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. But in Scotland, and in Wales as well, there is an independence party. In Scotland, it is called the Scottish Nationalist Party, which was founded back in the 1930s but became important in the 1960s and 1970s. In many ways, the Scottish Nationalist Party is like Labour. It draws the people who vote for Scottish National are quite similar to the people who vote for Labour. But it is pro-independence, and at least on paper, it is more pro-European Union. It is an important party, an important force for change. Now, Scotland's people are lucky because they are represented three times. And this is at a national level, not just at local level. At a national level, they are represented three times. The British Parliament in London, the Parliament for the United Kingdom, the Parliament to which Scotland surrendered its Parliament in 1707. The British Parliament in London is in many ways the most politically important. It deals with all policy except what is devolved to the Scottish Parliament. And I'll tell you what is devolved in a minute. There is the European Parliament in Brussels, set up in 1979, at which Scotland also has representation. It has a very small representation. The figure is on the handout. It's only seven MPs, members of the European Parliament. And then, since 1999, we have had the Scottish Parliament in Edinburgh. So those are the three national levels of representation. Something I tried to explain in my handout, but I won't go into in too much detail. The English people are only represented twice. And they are sometimes unhappy about this because Scottish members of the British Parliament in London can vote on English matters, but English MPs cannot vote on Scottish matters. And this creates a real tension. It is a tension within British politics now. But perhaps we will see that later. Now, the Scottish Parliament deals with things which are devolved, and these are written down. They are very broad. They are economy, environment, education, healthcare, housing, transport, and police. There are more, but these are the most important. But the Scottish Parliament cannot deal with certain issues, and these issues are called reserved matters. They can talk, if they want, about reserved matters, but they cannot legislate. And importantly, that is any aspect of foreign policy. They cannot make foreign policy. And that includes formal relationships with the European Union. Now, within the Scottish Parliament, and this is why the SNP is now an important player, it is the largest single party. The person who is the head of the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish Government, is called the First Minister, not the Prime Minister, as in the London Parliament, is a member of the SNP. So it is politically now important. It is the largest single party. Now, what impact does Britain's domestic politics have on the relationships of Scotland and the EU? The SNP like the European Union because it provides an alternative economic focus to England, which you will see in a minute is still very important to Scotland. And it is a political tool, it is a lever, it is something the SNP uses to gain political advantage. So it's a game, it plays with the EU. In some ways, the Scots have a more receptive attitude towards the European Union than is the case in England. I borrow there a phrase from the 19th century, attributed to Adam Smith. The English are much more laissez-faire. They have a strong central government, but they don't like the central government to do certain things for them. The Scots, especially on social policy and aspects like healthcare, are very keen to have central government directing where things go. Now, the EU, arguably, is very much about direction, about coordinating from the top downwards. And at that level, the Scots are sympathetic to the EU. Perhaps it goes with the history of the political development that I mentioned and all the economic and other links with the European Union. But everyone in Europe, I think, is ambivalent. They have more than one opinion sometimes about the European Union. Sometimes they think it's good, sometimes they think it's bad. And there are always tensions between national agendas and European agendas. And this is doubly problematic. It is a great difficulty because Scotland is not a member state of the EU. It has no right to make foreign policy. It can make overtures to anyone it likes, but it has no authority to make foreign policy, and it is not directly represented in the most important policy-making forums of the EU. Okay, so it is not a member state, and that makes it difficult. It is always one step away from the European Union. Now, politically charged issue, the most politically difficult issue now is, I think, one which I know the Japanese consul in Edinburgh, Mr. Suganuma, has dealt with himself. I believe he has been engaged in fisheries negotiations, and when he told us when we went to dinner, my wife and I, about fisheries, he looked like a man who was in despair. He said that fisheries is not just an economic issue, it's a social issue, it's a way of life. And this is also true for the common fisheries policy within the European Union. The common fisheries policy is made by the European Union to cover all the EU's waters. It is an example where the ambivalence about the European Union is clearest, and it is clearest from the Scottish National Party, which is, as I said, the most pro-European Union on paper. Scotland is the most important part of Britain for fishing. 70% of all the fishing takes place from Scottish ports. The SNP claim that the EU policy, the Common Fisheries Policy, discriminates against Scotland. It means that fish that are very close to Scotland are often caught by somebody else, and that the regulation of what can be taken from the sea discriminates against Scotland. So what the SNP have done with the Common Fisheries Policy is they have made a political issue for themselves from something which is supposed to be about the whole EU. So there is the tension. There is an example of the tension between the national and the European agendas. What is the EU's practical significance for Scotland? I have said that there is ambivalence in many parts of Europe towards the EU, and I think this is the reason why, for example, Ireland rejected the Lisbon Treaty in a referendum in June. People cannot decide, is the EU something which is far away and doesn't matter? Or is it interfering and complicating? Does it make too many decisions that could be made better at a local or even a national level? Despite this, and despite the ambivalence of the SNP, Scotland, I think, must stay in the EU, whatever happens. The reasons I have for saying that are three, I think. The EU has changed the way people think about politics, about subsidies, and about government. 80% of all national legislation now is either directly or indirectly influenced by what comes from the European Union in Brussels. The European Union is, in some areas, becoming more important. It is developing common foreign policies for the whole Union, and also common justice policies through the European Court. But the main imperative, I think, for Scotland to stay in the EU is economic, because of trade, because of investment, and because of the subsidies that certain regions of Scotland, like the Highlands, get from the European Union. Now, the importance is clearly shown. The importance of both the EU and the UK is clearly shown in exports. The most important export market for Scotland is not Europe or not the world, it is the rest of the UK, and that is mostly England. After that, half of Scotland's non-UK exports go to the EU, so that's roughly 20%. And a further 10% go to non-EU European countries like, for example, Iceland, Norway and Switzerland. The largest category of exports in Scotland, the largest single category that the Scottish Government announces, are electrical and instrument engineering. They comprise 30% of all Scottish exports. You would not expect me to come from Scotland and not tell you about why Scotch whisky is important. It is Scotland's single most valuable export, and it is also the fifth largest UK export earning manufacturer. So it is not only a symbol, but it is also economically important. With imports, the picture is more varied. Imports are mainly raw materials, clothing, and manufacturers like automobiles. 30% of non-UK imports come from Asia, and 30% from the EU. So in imports, Asia is as important as the EU. Also important, it's not strictly an import in economic terms, but I put it in there, is labour from Eastern Europe and the Baltic. Most of the developed world, I guess Japan and certainly the Anglo-Saxon nations, are experiencing a greying of the population. In other words, the population is getting older. There are more old people and fewer young people than there were in the past. The work preferences of the people who remain within Scotland are also changing. And as a result, you get significant immigration, especially from Eastern Europe, into low-skill and low-wage jobs. However, it is also worth bearing in mind that there are many English people in Scotland. 10% of Scotland's population was born in England, and in places like Edinburgh, perhaps one-fifth of those living in Edinburgh are English. So this is a way of saying that the EU is important economically to Scotland, but the UK remains very important too. So I think I have three more slides, and I look now, and this is the most dangerous thing for a historian to do, I look from the past, which is relatively safe, to the future, which is a little more dangerous. For three centuries since the Union of 1707, Scotland's economic focus was to the UK and the wider world. That is certainly still true. Scotland has an outstanding higher education system which attracts many international students, including many from south of the border in England. In the last 10 years, foreign direct investment to Scotland has been significantly higher than to the UK as a whole, and the reasons are Scotland has a number of incentives and advantages, it has good infrastructure, it has a well-educated and a relatively compliant labour force, it enjoys political stability and also a good national image, people generally like the Scots. And, crucially, it has EU membership, which gives access to the biggest trading bloc in the world. So the future, what about Scotland and the EU? Europe has, in the last 30 years, become more important to Scotland than in the previous 300 years. It has assumed, I have tried to show, economic, legislative, and political significance. The SNP, importantly, want Scotland to be independent, and they want it to be an independent member state of the European Union. It is an important plank in their argument for taking Scotland away from the Union and making it into a separate member state of the EU. Their slogan is Scotland in Europe, and what they mean is that Europe provides important trading opportunities. They mean that Europe, instead of being linked to England and getting political security and military security largely from association with England, there are 27 currently member states that could give the same security. And thirdly, they argue that English culture is not Scottish culture, and I tried to show at the beginning that that is quite true. So what they are also suggesting is that because Scotland has historic links with Europe, there is not so much need, perhaps, to look to the Anglo-Saxon world, to the world of England and North America, and more need, perhaps, and more opportunity to look to what is happening in Europe as we used to do for many centuries until the union with England. And fourthly, and this is really a very speculative suggestion, it may be that if Scotland was to become an independent member state, they might even join the European Monetary Union. Britain, the United Kingdom, is not a member of the Eurozone. It is not in the European Monetary Union. But it might be interesting economically for Scotland if we join the EU, if we join the Eurozone, because probably interest rates would fall. And also for the SNP, there is also a political point to be made. If you join the Eurozone, you join Europe and you separate yourself from England. And finally, the future, part three. What about Scotland and the UK? I've argued that the European Union has given a new economic focus. And that economic focus is particularly important because since the First World War, certainly for the last half century, Scotland has been trying to reconnect, to recreate the economic success it had between 1750 and 1914. In the last 20 years, it's been quite successful. Whether they will continue that success, I don't know. Europe is also an important political tool for the SNP, which it uses selectively as it articulates dissatisfaction, an emotional feeling that Scottish people perhaps don't want to be like English people, they don't want to be linked with English people. So the SNP uses Europe as a way of promoting independence. In my opinion, and this is now merely a statement of what I am, not of my academic profession, this aspiration is a mistake. Professor Saito was kind enough to call me a good Scot, and I think myself a good Scot. But some people define a good Scot only as people who want to be independent from England. And I think this is a mistake. I am a good Scot. I hope I am a good Scot. This was arrogant. I hope I am a good Scot who thinks that being linked to England has brought us much good and not a lot of bad things. Scotland, undeniably, no one denies this, has prospered in union with England in a way which I think would have been impossible had it not joined together. It has also benefited socially and politically, I think, too. For example, for the last century, and it is something the SNP don't like to hear, but it is true, the UK government has spent per capita 20% more in Scotland than in England. Now, part of the reason for that is that Scotland did need economic help for much of the 20th century, and it also had and has still more serious social problems than it is the case generally in England. So Scotland gets a direct benefit from being part of the UK, which I think it would find it very difficult to reproduce simply from the EU and simply from better economic growth. So what I have tried to argue is that in Britain, in Europe, and in the world, Scotland will do best with what it has, and that is now a partly independent, devolved government as part of the United Kingdom. Mr. Suganuma helped me with the pronunciation and the preparation of the introductory and the concluding part, and I will now try once again to destroy your language by saying, Honditsu wa gosecho arigato gozaimashita. Kono yo na subarashi kikai o itadaki kasanete ore moshi agemasu.